be nice to hear from you first, Umar. Do you really think that there's been any significant change in this nearly 10 years? And also maybe a little bit about the technicalities of how this election is going to be organised and whether it's going to be done in a significantly different way than previous ones?
I think it's an important question, especially anytime you kind of have elections coming up. I think it's time to reflect on what's been happening and the progress and whatnot. And if you take a longer term view and you look at where Somalia was 10 years ago, I mean, I absolutely do think there's been progress. You see groups like Al-Shabaab controlling less territory than they did before. And you see, you know, the formations of a federal state structure that have been put in place that weren't there, you know, 10 years ago as well. Having said that, the progress doesn't seem as fast as I think people would have imagined 10 years ago, nor does it seem as linear. And I think, unfortunately, the frustrations around this electoral process really kind of bring out that question: to what degree is Somalia continuing to advance and make progress? I think this election is quite disappointing in that regard, because essentially, when you look at it, you're having a system very similar to 2016-17 that's just slightly expanded. So yes, the number of delegates are doubled. So last time in this indirect process, you had about 14,000 people participating, and now it's going to be about 27,000. And the number of locations has also doubled. So two per federal member state. But of course, there's some challenges in achieving that as well. And so if you look at it from that perspective, you know, it's probably not as big of a jump as people wanted and people wanted to see around it. And I think that's a disappointing reflection, that one, that this progression isn't that big, but then two, that it was just so difficult to get to this election as well, and that it came at the cost of some violence reintroduced into the political scene. And so I think those are both disappointing aspects when you zoom in a little closer. When you take a wider view, I think, you know, you can see the progression, but the question is always, you know, at the end of the day, is this transitioning to something that's sustainable? You know, you still have a huge security commitment from the international community via AMISOM and other aspects. You still have a federal government that, you know, very much is dependent on external support as well. And so I think you see some of those steps, but I don't think you see them at a level that's advanced strong enough to really say that, you know, 10 years ago, this is enough progress in the past decade. And so that's where the challenge has lied, unfortunately.
Thanks very much, Umar. And if any other panelists want to jump in at any stage, please feel welcome to do so. Also, it'd be great if the audience could come up with some questions to ask the panel, if you start thinking about those and putting them in the question and answer icon at the bottom of your screen. Rukia, one thing, you know, that comes to mind when we're talking about democratization is that one thing I've certainly noticed in the 30 years since I've been reporting on and from Somalia, that basically it's the older men who dominate. And some of those names that I remember very well from the days of clan fighting and warlordism in the 1990s are still there. In terms of women, which you've spoken about, and that really did seem like it's going, like I said, rather backwards. In terms of women and also the younger people, how do you think that their participation could be increased? And also, do you have any genuine optimism that in the next 10 years they will be more involved and have more power politically?
Thank you. It's interesting because we're just talking about the decade since 2012 and the Somalia's rising, Mogadishu's rising. Storylines, which is critical to give hope, because many times Somalia has only been a definition of, you know, everything that, you know, a definition of failure. So that's critical. However, for me and for most women, how we look at progress in Somalia is not the posturing of political elites, traditional elders. It's about how has the ordinary Somali person in Somalia's life changed in that decade? How has service delivery changed? How has the maternity health of women changed? How has FGM and gender-based violence have changed? How has been justice has justice been served? Is impunity still the law of the land? Can a woman in Somalia, in any town in Somalia, feel secure, safe? Can she get education? Can she live in dignity? Not just women, all Somalis. And the question and the answer is, it's a difficult answer. And like Omar said, and like Abdunasa, it's not linear. We have some progress in some areas, and we largely depend on international international organization, international fundings. Some service, some areas in governance has improved, but the vast majority of Somalia, those 10 years has not progressed, has not bettered the lives of many women and youth. In terms of who dominates political arena, you mentioned 30 years ago, as you report from Somalia, the names, you know, may have changed, but the rule is still the same. Women and young people, particularly young women, I would say now, there's usually two options. One is to say, how can we help encourage the political elites, the traditional elders, the people who have the say, how can we help them kind of find the right way? How can we move the country progress forward? The other way is, how can we just create our own table, and how can we demand these changes and demand inclusive political changes? And one of the things that's really absent, and unfortunately, I know you want, we are all constantly looking for hope, and there's a lot to be hopeful about. But one thing that is clear is, now that you look at the political dynamics in Mogadishu, you look at the candidates, we are far away from a grassroots political change. We are far away from, you know, a courageous political movement. We are far away from leaders with conviction in changing the lives of Somali people. Right now, the rhetorics are the same, and we were recycling the same people that were there in 2012, that were there maybe in the mid 90s, late 90s. And so for women, one of the last point, for women, one of the most important things for us was, we wanted democratization to happen. We wanted to take the power away from the traditional elders and the men and to move it towards individual election. Now that's risky, because we've seen what happened in Somaliland. We've seen that even though they were, you know, there was a position, there was hope, many, many prominent Somaliland women politicians lost seats to sometimes not so prominent candidates who are males. So of course we understand that change is gradual. It needs to start from the grassroots, it needs to start from universities, it needs to start from colleges and even primary schools. But we want to move away from this. We want to move away from this indirect election. And so we're looking for Somaliland as an inspiration, but also as a lesson learned, that just because we are calling for democracy, does that mean if we don't have guaranteed laws that allows women to have these seats reserved? That's why the quota is important. The quota is not just a self-fulfilling prophecy. We just want quota and then we move forward. We understand that if more women are in political seats, life can change for the ordinary Somalis. If more women are empowered, then perhaps we can see that a bottom-up political transformation that we're looking for.
Thank you very much, Rukia, and it's certainly the case, and it's important that you brought that up, even though Somaliland won a lot of acclaim for its recent elections. Certainly, what happened with women, especially in the parliamentary polls, was really, you could describe it as embarrassing, and maybe not enough has been said about that. Abdunasser, in terms of election process in Puntland that you've just described, this experiment that's happening in the three districts, where do you think women are going to fit into this? Are they going to make any progress? Are they going to get any representation at all?
Yes, thank you very much. Actually, this was one of the questions that we asked the people that in our recent participatory poll. And we asked ways in which we can increase the participation and representation of women. And most of the people we interviewed believe that a woman quota could be a solution for this problem. Others believe that women need women responsive policies to be also adopted. So I think it is going to be still a problem, as we have just seen the experience in Somaliland. But I think it also offers experience that Puntland can draw from and put, you know, in place necessary mechanisms and also legal frameworks that can secure the greater participation and the representation of women, of which include that political associations include women in the first five top five names in their proposed list for local council elections. So we are trying now to learn from what they have seen in Somaliland, but I don't think it's going to be a problem that we solve immediately in Puntland.
Thank you very much, Abdi Nasir. Idil, as we saw earlier this year in terms of political violence erupting briefly in Mogadishu, in terms of the whole security picture in Somalia, given that it was made perfectly clear that some powerful politicians, presidential candidates, have got militias at their disposal, is there a sort of prediction or a concern that the security picture in Somalia will change, that whoever wins the election, that the people who are disappointed might turn to violence, as some predict? Or do you see the sort of principal threat for these elections still coming from Al-Shabaab, both in terms of kind of what happens during the elections and what happens afterwards?
Yeah, definitely we have experience in 2016 elections when presidents of some states try to bring their loyal candidate by force, like in Galmudug last time. So the current politicians are in mind, you know, and already they have their lessons learned. It's like, if this happened, we can do this. So in the issue of Hiran, you know, Hirshabelle, at the moment, Johar has less seats, Beledweyne has more seats. So, and most likely the president, Hirshabelle president, will try, you know, to have influence in Beledweyne, where Beledweyne, especially by clan-wise, they are feeling that because of the power-sharing clan dynamics, they're supposed to be the president, but because they couldn't get, so they are not accountable to Johar, you know. In such incidents, it's high likely to happen. We also have, you know, the fear of maybe Al-Shabaab will attack a candidate and the candidates blame an opponent and say that what happened in earlier this year, the government attacked me, and we will have already, we have a military. They are by ideology together, we can say at the moment, but if situation gets worse, we know everyone will go with their clan line. So it's most likely. You also have a ghetto. What's at the moment we hear that still there's no fine solutions for Gado administration. We don't know how it's going to happen. Will people come from, you know, Garbahare? Will that be accepted? Because they are going to represent Jubaland. What if Madowe administration is not going to accept in Garbahare? Also, when you look at the clans who live in Garbahare, they are not, you know, under one umbrella. You know, some they will say they're still in favor of Jubaland administration, and some they're in favor of the current administration. And those groups are already armed and they're living under one umbrella, they're one city. So there are fear, high fear of, you know, security. And we also see lately the issue when international community, what we have seen, it, they have a say, but how do you make sure that you don't cross the issue of sovereignty, which has become so high lately in Somali government officials saying that our sovereignty, you can't say this, you can't intervene in our internal issues. How the international community will say that you can't cross this? We need to have limits to inform, you know, the candidates to have a peaceful campaigns, you know, because already openly we have seen during, I think, May and April, some politicians openly, you know, violence, calling for their clans on social media. So how do we limit such individuals who are already a candidate at the moment? What do we tell them? Where is the line not to cross? So I think we need, by international community, we know they are the ones who fund Somalia elections, much of it. You know, where not to cross? We need, they have to come up with clear strategy and also responsibility from the Somali officials.
Thanks very much, Idil. And Omar, in terms of the foreign powers, I mean, there's such a variety of both regional and international countries that are involved in terms of, perhaps you could call it political manipulation, sometimes even perhaps having a role in the violence, certainly in terms of providing funding. Where do you think, I mean, if we look at Kenya and Ethiopia and Eritrea increasingly, but Ethiopia itself is in a state of serious conflict that seems to be getting worse by the day. And then you have countries like Turkey, the Gulf states, and then you obviously have some Western powers, the United Nations, AMISOM, so many different influences. How is that going to impact on the democratization process and the elections?
Yeah, I mean, you have a range of external actors that are very interested in Somalia, and in particular around the elections. Again, you know, in a narrow indirect electoral cycle, the costs of trying to manipulate or influence in that are reduced, not just for candidates, but also for international actors that have, you know, want to see a particular outcome. So I think that's quite a challenge. You know, some of the, when you're looking back at 2017, 16-17 elections, we saw a lot of external money, particularly from Gulf countries, political financing in this sort of aspect. And you compare it to today, you know, part of the issue is that countries bring their own baggage, their own competitive divisions, and they look at Somalia with a zero-sum sort of mindset. So every sort of gain for me is an offset, you know, for my adversary and whatnot. And, you know, in some ways, I think the competitive divisions geopolitically over the past few years have only increased. So, for example, you know, Ethiopia and Kenya don't really see eye to eye on Somalia these days, not in the way that they had some sort of accommodation a few years ago. You know, 2017 was before the outbreak of the Gulf Cooperation Council crisis, which, of course, there's been a Lula declaration. But I think what we've seen from that is, while that might regulate tensions between Qatar and UAE within the Gulf, you know, it hasn't really filtered out to their foreign policy so much anymore either. And so I think you still have these frames of competition that are going to, at some point, probably embed themselves within the Somali electoral cycle. Now, having said that, I don't think we've seen it so far just yet. And then I think if history is any indicator, you know, some of this might filter out a bit more once the process goes a little bit further, particularly after parliament might be settled and you have a better chance candidate-wise who might wind up you know, having a better chance of success. And so I think that's where we should really be monitoring and looking at quite closely. But it's quite a damaging effect, because I think it gravitates the process kind of away. It's already a narrow exercise, but it gravitates it away from responding to domestic sort of needs in Somalia. And more candidates, you know, you frequently see them traveling abroad during this period. And so kind of gravitating more towards the external side of the interest. So I think, you know, we'll probably see some sort of repetition. You know, one mitigating factor I would say, though, is you know, over the past few years, we've seen this you know, so-called tripartite alliance between Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia and whatnot. But we've also seen over the past, you know, 6 to 8 months, how consumed Ethiopia and Eritrea have been by Tigray. And I think, you know, that war's continuation really distracts, you know, from other sort of, you know, activities or external sort of engagements. And I think Somalia is one of those as well. So, you know, I think we see some accelerating factors in terms of the competitive divisions, but there's some mitigating factors that, you know, some countries might not be able to pay as much attention. You know, you've had the Gulf countries also affected financially from the COVID outbreak and whatnot as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, I would still expect this to flare up a little bit further down the road.
And in terms of Ethiopia, Omar, you were based there previously. how do you think what's happening there? I mean, now we've got forces from Oromia, from Dama, from Southern People's Regions, as well as the Amhara kind of being mobilized to go and join the war. If Ethiopia gets engulfed in a kind of general conflict, how will that impact on Somalia and on Somalia's political process and its electoral process?
Well, I mean, generally, as Ethiopia goes, you know, I think you can say a lot of the Horn goes. It's such a central part of the Horn. It's such a massive country. And Ethiopia getting engulfed in a long-term conflict, the type that we've already seen ongoing for the past 6 months, but honestly could really turn for the worse going forward, is hugely damaging for the entire Horn region. I mean, it's a hugely destabilizing aspect. Now, in terms of, you know, the direct impact on the immediate future in terms of the Somali elections, you know, I think it has that impact that you know, Ethiopia was supporting Farmaccio quite a bit. I don't think they're going to be able to play that role when it comes to the electoral side. We have to ask questions about, you know, Ethiopia has a security presence in Somalia as well. They've already withdrawn some bilateral forces. If they get engulfed in further conflict, does that affect their participation in AMISOM, for example, which could have wider security repercussions? So I think it's more of a long-term question about how this affects the wider Horn and destabilizes in Somalia in particular. But in the short term related to the election, I think, if Farmaggio was expecting kind of support from this tripartite dynamic, I just don't think it's going to flow in the way that he was expecting.
Thanks very much, Umar. And quite soon we're going to turn to questions and answers from the audience and the panel. So if people can start thinking up questions to ask the panel, that would be great, and just put them in that question and answer area. Rukia, in recent years, every 4 years or so, there's been elections in Somalia, and you get this kind of bunch of politicians in Villa Somalia who spend an awful lot of time squabbling amongst themselves, falling out with each other. Sometimes it feels like they're just, their minds are more in what goes on in terms of internal politics than in terms of the huge challenges that Somalia faces, not just in terms of security, but in terms of education, health, living conditions, and so on. Do you think sometimes that maybe 4 years is kind of a too brief electoral cycle, that maybe these politicians and presidents should have a bit more time to get to grips with trying to actually change the lives of the ordinary person in Somalia rather than being preoccupied with political feuding?
I mean, exactly. Yes. The short answer is yes. And I think the to expand on that, Idil Ibrahim mentioned the issue of security. It's Somalia security is obviously countrywide, but it does affect in terms of Al-Shabaab activities, more southern part of Somalia. They are active here in the north. They are active in Bosaso, for instance, and some parts of Muduk. But there are towns still today that Al-Shabaab either indirectly controls or directly is physically there. And one of the biggest issue with security and why we're not succeeding despite the millions of money spent by the international community, why have we not been able to win the war against Al-Shabaab and ISIS, is this political rotation that occurs. And sometimes, many times actually, the security apparatus is politicized. If you look at, for example, Danam, with the exception of one Colonel Ahmed Danam, who served 3 years, the rest of them were serving 6 years and were getting constantly removed. So when you have military and security sectors being politicized and being used for political leverage because of these ensuing 4 year elections, it creates lack of longevity. And security is a huge issue for women because when something goes down, as you have seen what happened in Mogadishu during the political deadlock, was women, before the gun even went off, many women were being displaced. They were leaving one area of Mogadishu to go to another area of Mogadishu. And same in terms of in other parts of Somalia. So yes, I would say to move forward, one of the craziest things, you know, it's like, you know, the definition of one of the of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Somalia is one thing. And I think the international community are also explicit, because we know that they know better and that this is not working. And keeping this lifeline going, it's only going to harm Somalia's progress in the long term. What we need is we need to create, instead of this posturing of, look at Somalia, it's politically, you know, we have these elections. We need to kind of commit to a model, and we need to stay through that model. I would personally say we can even do a 10-year period where a president stays, because what we need right now, we need service delivery, we need institutional building, we need security. And maybe perhaps if the elites and the politicians in Mogadishu can focus on, take a breather from this ensuing political exchange, maybe we can start building these institutions and stop politicizing and critical service delivery entities and security. So I do think, as you framed it, Mayor, really well, that Somalia needs to go beyond this 4-year cycle, because all it does is give, you know, the politician 2-year start where they're just trying to get their guys in, and then the next 2 years they're in campaign mode, mm-hmm. right? This administration has been in campaign mode since 2018. You know, so you can imagine what changes and what real transformation can happen in Somalia if that continues the way it is. And this is also, by the way, I just want to go ahead and make one point about Abdel Nasser. He mentioned about the Puntland, the pilot attempt to democratize Puntland after almost 23 years as it's, since its inception. And one of the things that are deeply disappointing, actually one of the positive, is the Deni administration actually started this early on. So this is the first time where a president came in to Puntland and right away started to nominate the Transitional Election Committee. However, it is clear now that the women are not visible in anywhere. I went to many forums, I went to Kharda when they were doing the registration. Something has to change. And I think learning from other, from our neighbors, learning from Somaliland means that we need to do something now immediately before we react to what happened. We already can see what's happening. There needs to be laws put in place. There needs to be a requirement that women has to get quota, both through the party systems, and also the TPEC has to create a mechanism where if there isn't a woman candidate representing these political parties, that they should say, go back, please include women, qualified women candidates into that. So I just want to add that.
Thanks very much, Rukia. And now we're going to go to the questions from the floor. I see that they're beginning to flood in. And there's one that's directed for you, Abdel Nasser, I would say principally, which is from Michael Odhiambo. And he's asking, in terms of regarding the Puntland experiment, how's the rest of the region, other than those three districts within Puntland, participating in these elections? So kind of how is the rest of Puntland getting involved?
Yeah, the idea of having an early elections was that first there was a financial issue, that the process was not getting enough support from both local and international friends and donors. And secondly, because it has taken too long for Puntland to test this process in Puntland, the commission wanted not to disappoint the people with another failure. So that's why they said, we want to test it with a smaller and controllable district. So once we have that successful an election in that three districts, it's expected that the experience gained from that success and that process helps inform the process and you know, at the next level of the process. And according to TPEC schedule, the local government elections are planned to take place across districts early or mid 2022. So that's how the plans are. And after holding all local government elections, we expected that this TPEC commission dissolve, chiefs and a new commission that is made up of representatives from the three qualifying political associations. The local government elections will qualify. Now we have 9 political associations. Of that, 3 will be political bodies. So that will make will constitute the permanent election commission that will replace TPEC now. So and it is their responsibility again to start in the implementation and the process to lay the foundation for the process of holding a parliamentary and presidential elections in Puntland. And probably still within the mandate of the current government, but we cannot predict it now. It may go beyond the term. But we hope once we have the political parties in place that's taking the equal responsibility of the election management and democratization, you know, success in Puntland. We hope that, that we will have more political stability in the region, and we hope that Puntland will be better positioned to help advise and mentor, you know, other member states, but also the Somali federal government.
If you allow me, Abdi Nasser, we've got a lot of questions, so I think we're going to move on to the next one now. And this one is actually follows on very directly from this issue. And this is from the Heinrich Böll Foundation, which was involved in setting this discussion up. And this question is, do you think that in light of the lack of substantial progress on the electoral system at the national level and the progress in Puntland and in its own way in Somaliland, that there could now be the opportunity to approach democratization from the more district level, from member states up, instead of from the national level down? I don't know whether, Umar, you want to have a think about that question, answer it, or if anyone else also has some responses.
Can I briefly respond to that?
Yeah.
This is the point that I wanted to talk about. We believe that as we think of democratizing the Somali political system, we need to also look at it from different angle. And this is the point I want to make. We believe that if we want a successful, credible, locally owned democratization process, we believe that it can emerge and also grow from a bottom-up approach. And we believe that all attempted process that wanted to support the democratization from top down has failed. And the good example that we can paint the picture from is the reality now in Somaliland and in Puntland and at a federal level, where we see that much effort has been spent in holding one person one vote at federal level, but it ended up with no result. Whereas the successful elections in Somaliland was actually funded from within, and Puntland is also suffering from lack of international and you know support, as I said, which is why they choose to have early elections to pilot it in 3 districts, meaning that if it is successful technically and politically. They wanted, TPEC and Puntland wanted to attract more attention from the internationals and from other, you know, friends to prove that elections and democracy is doable at federal and state level. So meaning the lessons that that's being drawn from a successful pilot initiative in Puntland will help inform a similar process in the rest of the Somalia. So I 100% believe that Somalia need to look at it from a different lens and different viewpoint and see it building its you know, peace and state building from bottom up and from building plots.
Thank you very much, Abdi Nasir. And it's interesting in terms of funding that Somaliland progressively over the years that it's been holding elections, each time more money comes from local revenue rather than international funding. It's been progressive each time, which I suppose means that the local population have a much sort of stronger sense of ownership and participation in the polls. Umar, it'd be interesting to have your thoughts in terms of whether you think that the bottom-up approach is more helpful to democratization than the top-down approach that we see in South and Central Somalia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question, and a number of the questions here, I think, in the chat basically bring up that point. And, you know, part of it is, I think, a reflection of frustration over this electoral process and how difficult it's been and how expectations were actually laid out quite high early on that this would be a one person, one vote process. You know, I always thought that was going to be a big jump to go from 14,000 people to, you know, a couple million in a few years, and maybe a gradual approach made a bit more sense. But I think, you know, it's really important then to watch what happens in Puntland. And I agree with Abdi Nasir, the most sustainable, the most useful sort of, progresses we've seen in Somalia have come from the bottom up, from this community level. And so, you know, I don't want to belabor that point, but I think it's a very important one. And sort of the frustration now is going to lead, I think, to a lot of reflection within not just domestically, but also the international community about different sort of approaches. And this bottom up is a useful one. The other point I'd make here is, you know, I wonder often, you know, why, what's the point of elections? You know, why are we having elections? You know, is it, you know, what's the ultimate goal here? Are we trying to have, you know, build the democracy? Is it good governance? Or is it extension of the state authority? Is it stabilization in Somalia? And, you know, it's probably a little bit of all of that, but maybe it's a bit too many things all at once. And, you know, I think we use elections often as a proxy to say, okay, well, this election happened, therefore it's democratic system, therefore we have good governance and everything kind of flows from that. But I think what we've seen, and I think Rukia mentioned this as well, we've had plenty of elections, you know, albeit indirect, but we've had plenty of elections in Somalia, not just at the federal level, but also at the member state level. You know, almost every, you know, 6 months or something, somewhere is having an election. But has that really translated then into the good governance side of things, into service delivery, into sort of the practical elements? And I think that's, you know, where using elections as a proxy for these other aspects also, you know, is a bit problematic. And so this process, I think, will allow international actors to maybe also reflect in terms of where priorities should be going forward. And one of those is probably investing in this bottom-up approach. And therefore, you know, what we see happening in Puntland, I think, is a very good example and very interesting to watch going forward, as it'll have a lot of ramifications.